Glacier Heart was mining country, and always had been. No man living had any clear idea of the full extent of shafts, galleries, and excavations which had been sunk into the bones of the world by generation upon generation of miners. There were charts and maps, yet no one was foolish enough to believe they were anything like comprehensive, or, for that matter, accurate. The mine which had been run under what eventually became Summit House was on none of those charts, none of those maps. It was very old, and Kinnear had often wondered who'd driven it. It was obvious that it had been following a thick bed of coal, but it was equally obvious that the coal had been playing out by the time the mine reached this point, and Summit House was literally miles away from the Greywater or the Terrace Canal. For that matter, Kinnear suspected this particular mine had been abandoned long before the canal had been built or the river's locks had been constructed. So even when it had been productive, just getting the coal to market must have been a backbreaking task. What mattered at the moment, however, was that one long-ago summer, Jason Kinnear had fallen through the well-rotted timbers, covering one of the mine's escape shafts. The shaft had been driven very near the end of the gallery directly under the lodge, with the result that it had been no more than 30 or 40 feet long. More importantly for Kinnear, it was steep but not vertical. He'd been bruised and winded by the fall, but he'd also been younger at the time, and curiosity had quickly displaced the urge to sit in the dark nursing a barked shin and muttering words of which Mother Church would not have approved. So he'd gotten back to his feet, returned to Summit House, and commandeered Garth Gorgia and Fraidman Thomas, both of whom had already discovered his passion for spelunking, a bag full of candles, a piece of chalk, and a ball of string. He still didn't know why he'd never mentioned his discovery to anyone else. It wasn't that he'd ever decided he'd best keep it secret, against some desperate future need to escape from the Inquisition. And to be honest, he should have mentioned it to someone else, especially if he intended to go on poking around inside the mountain. He hadn't grown up here in Glacier Heart, but as an experienced cave crawler, he'd been only too well aware of the dangers of cave-in, gas, water, accidental falls, all of the manifold ways the world could crush the life out of men rash enough to seek to steal its treasures. He'd been careful, and he'd never been so foolish as to go by himself, although, to be fair, neither he nor Thomas would ever again be able to claim the adjective spry. But he'd steadfastly kept the discovery to himself. Part of it, he'd later realized, was the quiet down in the mine. The stillness, the hush. The old coal mine was a far cry from the natural caves and caverns which had first drawn him into spelunking. It wasn't even very interesting when one came right down to it. It was simply a very long, very deep, very dark hole in the ground. Yet it was a very old hole, and one which had been made by the hands of man and not the patient wash of water. There was that sense of stepping into the past, of touching the lives of the miners who'd labored here scores, hundreds of years before Kinnear's own birth. In an odd sort of way, that mine had become a cathedral. Its hushed, listening stillness had become a perfect place for him to simply sit and contemplate and feel the presence of God. It had become, in many ways, his true spiritual retreat, and he'd shared it with no one except his secretary, his valet, and God. He'd never actually ordered the other two not to mention their discoveries to anyone else, but he'd realized long ago that both of them had recognized his desire to keep it to himself. He hadn't spent all of his time in the mine in meditation, however. In fact, he'd spent many an hour exploring, rambling through the galleries and shafts. The mountain was solid here, and he'd discovered little of the timbering which could yield to rot and age and create death traps. There was one gallery he'd assiduously avoided after one look at its roof, and he'd encountered several flooded sections which had, obviously, ended exploration in those directions. Still, he'd hiked more than a few miles under the earth's surface, marking the walls as he went, always trailing his string behind him in case of disaster. Now he paused, just inside the shaft he'd discovered so many years before, brushing matted snow off the front of his parka with mittened hands. The short hike from Summit House to the shaft entrance had been enormously harder than he'd let himself expect. The wind was even more violent than he'd thought, listening to it howl around the lodge, and the temperature was still falling. He and Thomas had transported a small stack of essential supplies to the shaft the day after they arrived at the lodge, and it was just as well they hadn't waited. Just the knapsacks each of them wore had been burdensome enough under the current conditions. He finished slapping off as much as he could of the thick skim of snow, then tugged off one mitten and dragged out his fire striker. It was cold enough, and his hand was shivering enough, that it took him longer than usual to get the bullseye lantern lit, but its glow, once he got the wick alight, was ample compensation for his efforts. Most people might have been excused for thinking that the bare, cold rock of the escape shaft's walls could be considered a welcoming sight, but most people weren't Jason Kinnear and didn't know the Inquisition was simply biding its time before it pounced.
"Well, so far so good," he said cheerfully.
"Aye?"
Thomas regarded him skeptically in the lantern glow.
"And how far would so far be being, Your Eminence?"
"The writ tells us the longest journey begins with the first step," Kinnear replied serenely.
"So it does, Your Eminence, and I'm not one to be arguing with the archangels. Still in all, though, it occurs to me we've quite a few other steps to be taking."
"Now that, Fraidman, is a very sound doctrinal point."
Kinnear picked up the lantern and lifted the pole of the two-man, two-wheeled cart on which their supplies were stacked.
"Shall we go?" he invited.
Several hours later, Kinnear's legs felt about as tired as they'd ever felt. It had been some time since he'd been this deep in the mine, and he'd forgotten how far it was. Or rather, he'd been younger the last time he'd been here, so he hadn't allowed for how much longer it had become in the interim. And it was going to be a great deal longer before they came out on the other side. In fact, it was going to be evening again by the time they could get there. He smiled wearily at the thought, sitting on the edge of the cart, gnawing on the sandwich Thomas had offered him. The bread was thick sliced, and the meat, cheese, and onions were delicious. He'd have liked a little lettuce as well, but lettuce wasn't something one saw a lot of in Glacier Heart in the winter. He'd considered for years having a greenhouse added to the Archbishop's palace, and he'd always meant to get around to it. Now, though... He'd brushed that thought aside, dug out his watch, and tilted it enough to make out its face in the lantern light. It was always easy to become disconnected from the world's time, down here deep in the earth. With no sight of sun or sky, no contact with weather, it was more difficult to estimate the passing hours than someone who'd never made the attempt might have guessed. At least the mine maintained a constant, unwavering temperature, although he would never have made the mistake of calling it warm, and despite the need to weave their way through the complex pattern of underground passages, they'd made much better time than they would have made into the teeth of the blizzard, howling around the outside of the mountain. Still, they had to reach their destination within the window of time his mysterious letter writer had defined.
"We need to move on," he said after swallowing a mouthful of sandwich.
"No doubt."
Thomas handed him a deep mug filled with beer.
"And as soon as you finish that sandwich, its moving on will be."
"I can chew and walk at the same time," Kinnear said mildly, putting his watch back into his pocket in order to free up his hand and accept the mug. "For that matter, I can swallow and walk at the same time if I concentrate hard."
"The fact that you can do it isn't to say as how you do it well, Your Eminence," his unimpressed henchman responded. "Now eat."
Kinnear looked at him for a moment, then shook his head, but meekly, and ate.
"And did stopping to eat put us behind schedule after all, Your Eminence?"
There was only the merest trace of satisfaction, by Fraidman Thomas's standards, in the question, and Kinnear shook his head in resignation. The only thing worse than Thomas's being right about something like this were the almost unheard-of occasions when he was wrong, at which point he could become extremely difficult for a mere archbishop to put up with.
"No, Fraidman, we're actually a bit early," he admitted.
"Fancy that now," Thomas murmured.
Kinnear very carefully failed to hear the comment.
"So now what do we do, Your Eminence?" the valet asked after a moment.
"We poke our heads outside and see what the weather looks like,"
Kinnear said, gathering up the bull's-eye lantern, and proceeded to do just that. He had to crouch as he approached the mouth of the tunnel. As nearly as he'd been able to determine from his explorations, the tunnel through which he was now making his way had been driven, probably, many years after the main mine had been abandoned. It had come from the outside, and he wondered how the people digging it had reacted when they'd broken through and discovered that someone else had already dug out the coal they'd hoped to discover. Fortunately, they hadn't had to go all that far to make the discovery. The tunnel was barely 100 yards long, and it had never been more than a rough-edged shaft. He had to pick his way with a certain degree of care, especially since he didn't want to get too close to the tunnel mouth with a lit lantern. About 15 yards from the end of the tunnel, he closed the lantern slide and proceeded slowly and cautiously, one hand feeling along the wall. He felt the cold intensifying as he got closer and closer to the mountainside, and he wondered once again what had inspired the letter writer to pick the spot for which he and Thomas were bound as one of the rendezvous he'd set up. It was a logical enough choice in a lot of ways, a modest backcountry posting house at a crossroads. Not on the main high road, but where two country roads, mountain country roads, met and nodded to one another in passing, before they continued on their ways. One of those roads, although it was very little used in the winter, linked two minor cities just over 100 miles apart. The twisting, turning, climbing, and diving nature of mountain roads explained why people usually chose to use the high road, which skirted the central mass of the Terrace Range, and, while longer, traveled through what passed for bottomlands in Glacierheart. The second road was even less heavily used in winter. It headed generally southwest toward the southern edge of the Terrace Range and the city of Mountain Lake on the shore of Glacierborne Lake. This time of year, there wouldn't be much traffic for the posting house to serve. The owners would be delighted to see any customers they could get, and it was isolated enough to make it unlikely that news that a stranger was hanging about would reach Terrace before the time window closed and he was gone. On the other hand, it wasn't exactly conveniently located from the perspective of the Archbishop's palace. In fact, it was almost 80 miles from Terrace as a wyvern might have flown, and over 300 by road. Assuming there'd been a road from Summit House to the crossroads, Kinnear would still have to have crossed the better part of 45 miles of winter mountainside. Of course, thanks to the abandoned coal mine, he and Thomas would emerge from their subterranean passage little more than 15 miles from their destination. But someone writing from what had to be Zion could scarcely have counted on that. From that distant a perspective, this was clearly the least convenient of the three rendezvous points the letter writer had proposed, and the Archbishop suspected it was actually little more than a last hope fallback position. It seemed unlikely anyone could have genuinely expected Kinnear to somehow reach the posting house. "And now that we're here," Kinnear thought, picking his way cautiously through the blackness, "I still don't know how I'm supposed to walk into the posting house and make contact. It's not exactly as if I'm the least well-known man in Glacierheart. I can always hope no one will recognize me this far from Terrace, but somehow I think counting on it might not be the smartest thing I could possibly do. So how do I discreetly..." His thoughts chopped off, and he froze as his dark accustomed eyes suddenly widened. Light. There was light ahead, and...
"Actually, Your Eminence," a voice said from ahead of him, "I rather expected you last night."
Kinnear's eyes went wider than ever. It couldn't be.
"Garth?"
he heard his own voice say hoarsely. "Well," his secretary said, emerging around the bend in the tunnel with his own bullseye lantern and smiling broadly, "having me involved did make delivering that letter a bit easier, now didn't it, Your Eminence?"
"You're mad, Garth,"
Jason Kinnear said with soft, firm emphasis several minutes later.
"God knows I've spent years keeping you clear of all this. And you're a father, and Samantha's pregnant for Pasquale's sake."
"Yes," Garth Gorgia agreed with a remarkably calm nod. "Clinton's timing on all of this could have been much more considerate, don't you think?" He gave his superior a decidedly stern look, his youthful face older in the lantern shadows. "And if you truly thought you'd managed to keep me ignorant of your activities all this time, Your Eminence, I can only say I am astonished that such an inept conspirator managed to get away with it this long."
"But,"
Kinnear began. "Your Eminence, we can argue about this as long as you want," Gorgia interrupted. "But I really think we ought to get underway while we do it. Unless you want to turn around, climb all the way back up through that mountain, and simply forget about it. I wouldn't recommend that, though. I'm pretty sure that awful lizard Teigman expects orders to arrest you any day now." Kinnear closed his mouth, and Gorgia reached out to touch his arm gently. "Your Eminence, you didn't recruit me. Whatever I'm doing because I choose to do it. And Samantha had a pretty fair idea of how I think, what I believe in, before I ever asked her to marry me. I haven't done anything without consulting with her, and she supported me every step of the way. Trust me, she agrees with you about Clinton's timing, and I'm not saying she's not, that we both aren't scared to our marrow, thinking about what could happen to us, and especially to the kids. But it's not as if we never saw this coming, either."
"But what is it you are doing, Garth?"
Kinnear asked.
"Somehow I don't think you've simply been sitting around, keeping an eye on me just in case I got into trouble. And if you haven't been actively involved in what I've been doing, then what have you been involved in?"
"The truth is, Your Eminence, that I have been basically sitting around keeping an eye on you," Gorgia shrugged. "I'll tell you all about it as soon as I can, as soon as I have permission to. For right now, though, just accept that someone else knew about you and your friends in the temple. I don't know who those others are, and I don't know everything you've been up to. I do know now why you had me doing some of the research in the Archbishopric's records, why you were looking for proof of corruption or of directives from the temple that were less than appropriate for one of God's vicars or archbishops to be issuing, shall we say. And I understand now why you've taken some of the stances you've taken, despite the fact that you knew they were going to be wildly unpopular with other members of the episcopate. I'll admit it hurt at first when I realized there was something deep and dangerous going on that you weren't telling me about. I thought, at the beginning, that you didn't trust me. Or even worse, you didn't think I felt the same things you felt when I looked at how Mother Church was falling so far short of what she ought to have been.
Then I realized you were doing it to protect me, and, later, to protect Samantha and the kids, and I loved you for that.
His hand tightened on Kinnear's arm, and his voice hoarsened for a moment. He paused and cleared his throat, then continued.
I loved you for it, and I realized you were right. I did have other people to worry about. Hostages to fortune, as Bedard put it. So I let you go ahead and exclude me. But when I was contacted by someone else who knew about your activities, and when that someone else convinced me he wasn't the Inquisition in disguise, and that all he wanted me to do was to stay right here in Glacier Heart to coordinate ways to get you out if whatever you were doing finally blew up in your face, I was delighted. Delighted, Your Eminence. Whoever your friend in Zion is, he sent me word months ago that this was coming, and I've been making my arrangements ever since. Teigman never even noticed. As a matter of fact, I've been one of his informants for the last couple of years now.
The secretary smiled nastily.
That was one of the things your friend in Zion suggested, as a way to make certain there was no suspicion pointed in my direction. I can't pretend I've enjoyed having him believe I actually think the same way he does, but your friend was right about what a perfect cover it made. Every single word I've ever reported to him has been true, too, so I'm sure I'm considered a very reliable source. With the added advantage that he's been so busy watching you that I'm sure he never even glanced in my direction.
The underpriest shrugged.
So, Your Eminence, the upshot is that Samantha and the kids are waiting at the posting house, the owner of which happens to be a cousin of hers. He doesn't know exactly what we're doing, but he does know you're in trouble, and like quite an amazing number of people here in Glacier Heart, he loves you. All he has to do is not mention ever seeing us, because I don't think it's going to occur to the Inquisition that you somehow managed to get from Summit House clear around to the other side of Mount Terrace during one of the worst blizzards in the last 30 years. I don't think they're going to believe you could have gotten back down the mountain and escaped through Terrace itself, either. But that's going to seem a lot more reasonable to them than this does. So I expect they're going to concentrate their efforts on traffic in and out of Terrace. In fact, this time of year, I think they're almost going to have to concentrate their main efforts on the Greywater and the river road to Mountain Lake and then on to Siddar City. In the meantime, though, we're going to be heading west into Cliff Peak, then swinging south across the South March into Silkaia.
Kinnear stared at him. He had no idea who his mysterious benefactor might be, or how anyone could have had the foresight to arrange something like this so long in advance. And despite everything Gorgia had just said, there was a part of him which railed against involving his secretary, and especially the underpriest's family, in his own dangers. But it was evident that things were out of his hands, at least for the moment.
"The writ says God works in mysterious ways, Jason," he reminded himself. "And remember what you were thinking when you first got that letter, how it proved there were others who saw what you'd seen and recognized what you and the Circle had recognized."
His lips twitched wryly.
"And who seemed to have organized themselves just a bit more effectively when it comes down to it. If there are still people who can put something like this together, without even me noticing a thing along the way, and actually pull it off, then it looks as if Clinton and Trinair's neat little house may have more spider rats in the foundations than I'd ever imagined. I think Samuel's right, that real change, real reform, is going to depend on the external threat of the Church of Caris. But maybe, just maybe, there are going to be more people inside Mother Church prepared to act than Clinton ever suspected or I ever hoped."
He felt a brief burn of shame with the last thought. Shame for the arrogance which had kept him from suspecting that those other people were there. For having excluded Garth Gorgia, however noble his motives,
from something the young priest obviously had wanted so badly to be part of. For having doubted that God could find the hearts and souls he needed whenever he decided to call them. He reached out and laid one palm against the side of the younger man's head, cupping his cheek, and smiled at him in the lantern light.
"I still think you're mad," he said softly. "But if you are, so am I. And sometimes a madman is exactly what God needs."
3. HMS Chihiro, 50, Garath Bay, Kingdom of Dolar.
"My lord, Bishop Stiefen and Admiral Holland are about to come alongside."
The Earl of Thirsk looked up from the report on his desk as the rather dashing young man with coal-black hair stuck his head respectfully into the day cabin with the announcement. "Lieutenant Abel Bardilon, Sir Abel Bardilon on social occasions, was the youngest brother of the Baron of Westbar. His brother's barony was located in the southwestern corner of the Duchy of Winborn, which happened to be completely landlocked. Despite that, Bardilon had made his preference for a naval career clear at an early age. In fact, according to his somewhat exasperated brother, his very first sentence had been, 'Avast there, you nanny!' Most people considered that a likely exaggeration, but his family, which had provided officers to the Royal Army since time out of mind, truly had done its best to dissuade him from such an unnatural step. Stubbornness, however, was one of young Bardilon's most pronounced characteristics, and his various brothers, sisters, cousins, aunts, and uncles had given up the task before he turned 20. His parents had been wise enough to abandon the effort much sooner than that. Now, about 5 years later, young Bardilon had found himself assigned as Thirsk's flag lieutenant. He had not, to put it mildly, thought much of the assignment when it was first offered to him. He would vastly have preferred the command of one of the Navy's new brigs, or, failing that, a first lieutenancy on one of the galleons. And to be fair, he would have been qualified for either. True, he wasn't the seaman many of the Navy's old sailing masters were, yet unlike altogether too many of the old Navy's officers, he'd made a conscientious effort to acquire at least the rudiments of seamanship, and there'd never been anything wrong with his courage or fighting ability. Despite that, he'd resigned himself to his new post with a minimum of complaint. He later admitted to Thirsk that his original intention had been to do his best brainless noble fop imitation to convince Thirsk to replace him, but he'd gotten over that quickly as he found himself plunged into the enormous task of building a brand new navy, a navy based on the professional Carisian model from the waterline up. Unlike too many old Navy officers, he'd not only understood what Thirsk wanted to accomplish, but actually approved wholeheartedly. He was also astute enough to recognize the enemies Thirsk was making along the way, and the Earl's unflinching willingness to do just that had won Bardilon's admiration. Admiration which had transmuted into devotion over the past strenuous 5 days and months. Which probably explained the trepidation hovering behind his eyes. It was well hidden, that trepidation, but Thirsk knew him too well not to see it.
"Thanks for the warning, Abel," the Earl said now mildly, as he heard the bosun's pipes and the rush of feet across the deck.
Captain Bykett had obviously spotted the approaching barge and called away the proper side party.
"Please go and make certain Martins prepared to join us," Thirsk continued. "And tell Pierre to break out a bottle of my best whiskey, then stand by to escort our guests aft."
"Yes, my lord."
Bardilon started to withdraw, but Thirsk's raised finger stopped him.
"Yes, my lord."
"I've known Admiral Holland for a great many years, Abel, and so far at least, I've heard that Bishop Stiefen is fairly reasonable.
I don't anticipate finding myself locked in a death struggle with either of them in the next few hours.
He smiled ever so slightly.
I trust I make myself clear?
Yes, my lord, of course.
Bardillon might have colored just a bit, although it was difficult to tell against his dark and darkly tanned complexion. Then the young man smiled a bit sheepishly.
Sorry about that, my lord, he said in a more natural tone. It's just...
He broke off with a quick little headshake, and Thirsk's smile broadened.
Trust me, Abel, I know exactly what it is, and I appreciate your loyally supportive attitude, shall we say?
His eyes glinted wickedly as Bardillon raised one hand in the gesture of a fencer, acknowledging a touch.
I think it's fairly evident no one could be moving the shipyards along any faster than we are, though, the Earl continued, his smile fading into a more sober expression. And Duke Thorast and his friends are just going to have to put up with my little training missions, I'm afraid.
Bardillon looked very much as if he would have liked to argue about that last statement. Although his older brother was a mere baron, Bardillon was a distant cousin of Duke Winborn's, and he'd absorbed the realities of the deadly infighting between the Kingdom of Dolar's great nobles with his mother's milk. He was well aware that the Duke of Thorast and his allies, however deeply they might protest their loyalty in public, never missed an opportunity to slide another dagger into Thirsk's back. At the moment, they were concentrating on the disgraceful slothfulness with which the fleet was being built, on the one hand, and on the Earl's ill-considered and manifestly dangerous training exercises on the other. All of which, whether or not the Earl chose to admit it worried him, obviously had a little something to do with this morning's meeting.
Go on now.
Thirsk made shooing motions with one hand. Bardillon gave him a quick smile, nodded, and disappeared, and Thirsk gathered up the report he'd been reading and jogged the pages neatly together. He put them into a folder, slid the folder into his desk drawer, and climbed out of his chair to walk across to the cabin's great stern windows. He folded his hands behind him, gazing out through the salt-mottled glass at Garath Bay. It was cold, with a brisk wind raising a wicked chop, and he hoped Bishop Stiphon Mike and Admiral Powell Holland hadn't gotten themselves too badly soaked during the long row out to Chihiro. Whether they'd managed to stay dry or not, they were undoubtedly going to be thoroughly chilled. And he looked over his shoulder as Pyer Sabrahan, his valet, quietly entered the cabin. Sabrahan was a smallish man, even shorter than Thirsk, with quick, deft hands, who was extraordinarily efficient and not at all shy about bullying his admiral into remembering to do little things like eat or sleep. He was also an excellent cook, who could probably have earned a lucrative living as a chef if he'd chosen to, and Thirsk had total confidence in his ability to manage the Earl's wine cellar and spirits. Despite that, the valet had never been popular with the other members of Thirsk's staff, domestic or naval. They appreciated his good qualities, but they were also only too well, one might say painfully well, aware of his vanity and second-hand arrogance. Sabrahan was far more concerned with the deference due to someone of Thirsk's birth and rank than the Earl himself had ever been. He'd been known to drive the staffs of inns and hotels to the edge of sanity, with demands for fresh linens, clean towels, hot water now, and no excuses, if you please. He was completely capable of doing the same thing aboard ship, and he had a well-earned reputation for browbeating the valets and stewards of mere ship's captains mercilessly. None of which even considered his legendary rows with the cooks and pursers of various flagships over the years. Thirsk was as well aware of his valet's foibles as anyone, and Sabrahan knew better than to try anything of the sort in the Earl's presence. At the same time, Thirsk was also aware of how difficult it would have been to find an equally capable replacement. Besides, Sabrahan had been with him for almost 8 years. Now, the valet pattered quickly across the thick carpet covering the deck, set a large silver tray with 2 decanters of whiskey and 1 of brandy on a side table, and turned to face Thirsk.
"I've brought the Stallman, the Waken, and the Thariston, my lord," he said, indicating the decanters. "Will that be satisfactory?"
"Eminently," Thirsk agreed.
"I've also informed the galley that you will be requiring hot chocolate for your guests, should they so desire,"
Sabrahan continued.
"And as you instructed, luncheon will be ready to serve at 14 o'clock promptly."
"Good." Thirsk bobbed his head, then looked past the valet as Martin Vonwick, his personal secretary and senior clerk, entered the day cabin. The secretary was considerably taller than Sabrahan, despite the slight stoop of his shoulders, and he was a bit nearsighted. Despite that, he was one of the best secretaries Thirsk had ever been fortunate enough to possess, and he and Sabrahan hated one another cordially.
"Well, fair's fair,"
the Earl thought dryly, as he watched the two of them very carefully not glaring at one another in his presence.
"I think just about everyone hates Pierre, really. And much as I hate to admit it, he gives them plenty of justification."
"If you're satisfied, my lord, I shall withdraw and attend to the arrangements," the valet said.
Thirsk nodded in agreement, and Sabrahan drew himself up, bowed slightly, and withdrew with stately majesty, somehow managing to completely ignore Von Wick's existence in the process.
"Langhorne," Thirst thought. "And I thought the blood between me and Thorast was bad."
He was still chuckling at the thought when Lieutenant Bardolon knocked on his cabin door once more.
"Enter,"
Thirsk said, and crossed the cabin quickly to greet his visitors. Powell Holland was about Thirsk's age, a foot or so taller, and considerably less weather-worn looking. Auxiliary Bishop Stephen Mike was about midway between Thirsk and Holland in height, with thick silver hair and lively brown eyes. He was a vigorous man, radiating a sense of leashed energy, although Thirsk had been told the bishop had a serious weakness for sweetbreads. According to the Earl's sources, that weakness for sweets was one reason Mike was so fanatical about exercising. Those same sources said Mike did his best to conceal that weakness, apparently in the belief that it went poorly with the Order of Schuler's reputation for austerity and self-discipline. For himself, Thirsk found it rather reassuring, an indication that Schulerite or not, official intendant of the fleet or not, the bishop was also a human being.
"My lord,"
the Earl greeted Mike first, bending over his extended hand to lightly kiss the bishop's ring of office. Then he straightened and held out his hand to Holland, who smiled broadly as he took it.
"Powell?"
"Admiral," Mike responded with a smile. "It's good to see you, although I must confess that the trip across the harbor was somewhat more brisk than I had allowed myself to hope it might be."
"I'm sorry to hear that, my lord. As you know..."
"Please, my lord,"
the bishop said, raising his left hand, index finger extended.
"I'm perfectly well aware of the reasons, the official reasons, for our meeting out here."
"My lord,"
Thirsk said a bit cautiously, and the bishop chuckled. It was not a particularly amused sound, however, and those lively brown eyes were narrow.
"I said I'm aware of the official reason we're meeting aboard your flagship, rather than in a comfortable office somewhere ashore," he said now. "And I'm also aware of the unofficial reasons, such as the list of who else might have been attending any meeting in the aforesaid comfortable office ashore."
"I see."
Thirsk faced the bishop, his own eyes calm, and Mike studied his expression for a long moment. Then the churchman smiled again, a bit crookedly.
"By an odd turn of chance, my Lord Admiral, I happen to agree with your strategy in this instance. I realize I shouldn't say that, For that matter, I suppose I really shouldn't admit I'm aware of the bad blood between you and Duke Thorast at all. Unfortunately, it serves no one's purposes for me to do anything of the sort.
My lord, I regret the bad blood you've mentioned, Thirsk said levelly. I agree that it exists, however, and I'm very much afraid things have been made still worse by the decisions I've been forced to make, or rather by the Duke's resistance to and resentment of those decisions.
The truth, Earl Thirsk, Mike said, walking across the cabin to seat himself in one of the armchairs facing Thirsk's desk, is that Thorast hates you. It's true he resents your decisions, but his resistance to them stems far more from the fact that they're your decisions than anything having the least bit to do with their actual merit. Which, considering that you're the one who made them, I very much doubt he's bothered to consider at all.
Despite himself, Thirsk's eyes widened slightly at the bishop's bluntness, and Mike chuckled again, this time with genuine humor. Sour humor, perhaps, but genuine.
Of course I'm aware of the situation, he said. I'd be a poor choice for the Navy's intendant if I weren't. Unfortunately, I don't see an easy solution to the problem.
He paused and waved at the armchair beside his own and at Thirsk's desk chair.
Please, gentlemen, be seated.
Both admirals obeyed, although Thirsk found himself concealing a slight smile at how effortlessly Mike had assumed at least temporary ownership of his day cabin. The bishop glanced across at Von Wick, but he'd apparently already assessed the secretary's discretion, and he turned his attention back to the Earl.
The fact of the matter is, he said, that I don't believe anything you could possibly do would compensate, in Thorast's view, for the fact that you were entirely right before Armageddon Reef and his brother-in-law was entirely wrong. He's never going to forgive you for the incredible insult of having proved Duke Malachi was a complete feckless incompetent.
Thirsk felt himself settling back into his chair, and the bishop showed a flash of teeth in a tight, fleeting smile.
There are limits to the amount of open resistance Thorast is prepared to demonstrate, he continued in an almost clinical tone. At the moment, King Ronald has made it clear to him that attacking you too openly would be inadvisable. I've also made that point to him in my own rather more subtle fashion, and so has Bishop Executor Arrain. So, at the moment, he's going to restrict himself to the sort of innuendo it's almost impossible for even the Inquisition to positively trace back to its source. And he's going to obey any order you give, although, as I'm sure you're aware, he isn't missing the opportunity to append his own carefully reasoned reservations to many of those orders in his reports to me. Mike grimaced. That, unfortunately, is his right and privilege.
My lord, Thirsk said, I won't pretend I'm not aware of everything you've just said. I have to admit, however, that I never expected you to approach those points quite so forthrightly.
The truth is, Admiral, Mike said somberly, that Thorast's alliances are ultimately far stronger and reach far higher than yours do. And he's been playing this sort of game all his life. All you have on your side are virtue, intelligence, courage, skill, experience, and integrity, which, alas, are of far more value on the field of battle than in the dagger-prone atmosphere of council chambers and salons. Ultimately, unless something changes radically, he will succeed in destroying you. And the fact that you've committed the unforgivable sin of being right, when all of his cronies were just as wrong as he was, will only make it easier for him when the present emergency passes.
Thirsk simply looked at him across the desk, and the bishop studied the admiral's expression. Then he nodded slowly.
I see I truly haven't said anything that surprises you, my lord. That only strengthens my already high regard for you. And I give you my word that so long as I remain the Navy Intendant, I will bear Duke Thorast's attitude and the reasons for it fully in mind. At the moment, you have my full support, and frankly, I foresee no circumstances which would be likely to change that. As I'm sure you also know, however, and as I'm not supposed to admit, Mother Church is far from free from the pernicious effects of politics and cliques. Duke Thorast has long-standing relationships with several powerful members of the clergy. It's entirely possible, no, let's be honest, it's virtually certain that he's prepared to use those relationships to undermine me as well as you, once he becomes aware of how unlikely I am to support him in any clash between the two of you. I mention this because the only means I see of keeping you where you are, doing what so badly needs to be done, is for the two of us to produce success while everyone is still worried enough to give us, or rather you, your head. Not just minor successes either. Not just getting the fleet built and manned. That's obviously the first essential. But to truly blunt the Duke's attacks, it's essential that we demonstrate we can produce victories. You were right before Rock Point and Crag Hook, but we lost both of those battles anyway. Now you must prove not only that you're right once again, but that listening to you leads to victory. It was very quiet in the day cabin for several seconds. Then Thirsk exhaled sharply and cocked his head at Mike. "I can't promise victory, my lord," he said quietly. "First, because no man can ever promise victory, but secondly, because no matter how well we build and how hard we train, we'll still confront the Carizian Navy. Call it the Imperial Navy or the Royal Navy, it's still the same fleet, with the same admirals, the same captains, and the same crews. They aren't supermen. They can be defeated. But at this moment in time, they are the best trained, most experienced battle fleet on the seas of Safehold. Quite possibly the best trained and most experienced battle fleet ever to sail the seas of Safehold, in fact. I'm not arguing against facing them at sea, and I'm willing to do so. Yet the truth is that we're likely to suffer more reverses before we achieve many victories. We're in the process of learning our trade, and altogether too many of our officers and our seamen are terrified, whether they're willing to admit it or not, of the Carizian's reputation. And they're right to be concerned, because that reputation was fully earned even before Rock Point, Crag Reach, and Darko Sound. We'll have to demonstrate to our own people that they can beat Carizians before they will be able to beat them in pitched battle. The bishop looked back at him, his expression thoughtful.
"Well, that's certainly candid," he said dryly.
"I refuse to be anything else," Thirsk said flatly.
"So I've noticed."
Mike leaned back in his armchair, fingertips steepled together in front of his chest, lips pursed.
"What I seem to hear you saying, Admiral," he said after a moment, "is that you believe you can build a navy which will eventually be able to meet the Carizians on an even footing, but that you believe it's going to be necessary to blood our officers and men first, and that in the blooding process we're likely to see at least some additional defeats?"
"I think it's very likely that's exactly what will happen," Thirsk replied. "I could be wrong, and I'd like to be. It's possible we'll be given an opportunity to bring our numbers to bear sooner than I expect. And I assure you, my lord, that I intend for any squadron of ours that goes into action to do so planning on winning, not expecting even before the first shot is fired that defeat is inevitable. Moreover, wind and wave play no favorites, and the Carizian's resources are stretched to the limit. They can't be strong everywhere, and if we can pounce on a few detachments, cut them up in a few local engagements before we commit to a full-fledged battle, the situation is likely to change in our favor. I simply can't promise that will happen, and absent some set of circumstances like that,
We're going to take more losses before we hand the enemy a significant loss of his own. If I can complete my training programs, and if I can get our current flag officers and our current ship captains to start thinking in terms of galleon tactics and galleon-based strategy, then, ultimately, I expect us to win. We have the numbers and we have the resources. The plain cold fact is that we don't have to be as good as they are on a ship-for-ship basis, as long as we can build enough more ships and be almost as good as they are. That's what I think I can give you, whether I'm still around to command it or not. The day cabin was even quieter, as the Earl admitted that out loud to someone at last, and Mike regarded him with a long, steady gaze.
I understand, the bishop said finally, and my respect for you has just increased still further. I hope you're wrong, that you'll have the opportunity to win those victories for us in command of the Navy you're building.
At the same time, I think I now more fully understand exactly what it is you're trying to accomplish. The reason, for example, why you've been so adamant about building squadrons, not just single ship's companies, and then sending those squadrons to drill at sea, despite weather damage.
Mike glanced at Holland, who still hadn't said a word. Yet it was evident from the other admiral's expression that he hadn't kept silent because he disagreed with Thirsk, and the bishop nodded slowly as he recognized Holland's support for the Earl's position.
You realize, my lord, he said, turning back to Thirsk, that Thorast has been criticizing your operations on that very basis.
The bishop grimaced.
He can scarcely criticize the way in which you've accelerated the building and manning aspects of your duties. So he's reserved his fire for the way in which you're organizing the ships as they come forward, and how hard you're driving them. In essence, his position is that since it will be some time still before the bulk of our construction is ready to be placed in commission, it makes little sense to send such small forces to sea, especially in the winter and especially when they keep returning with damage that requires repairs and diverts yard workers from the new construction. Better to conserve our strength here in port, where we can carry out gun drill and sail drill in safety, until all of it is ready to deploy. After all, what's the point in losing hard-to-replace spars and masts and sails to winter gales, when there's not a single Carizian galleon within 2,000 miles of Garath Bay?
We're not losing just spars and masts, my lord. We're also losing men, Thirsk admitted unflinchingly. But that's because the only place to learn seamanship is at sea, and saltwater is a harsh teacher. Whether we like to admit it or not, Carizian seamen are the finest in the world, and Karis has a far greater pool of trained seamen to draw upon. A huge percentage of our crews, on the other hand, are made up of landsmen, and if they haven't learned the seaman's trade by the time they cross swords with a Carizian squadron, then we might as well prepare them to haul down their colors right now.
The Earl grimaced and shook his head.
Of course, I realize Duke Thorast has been criticizing me for my penny packet deployments and the cost of repairing damaged ships. And of course, he's been hammering away at the way in which I'm throwing away the lives of our seamen as well. And the truth is that if we had the time to do this any other way, I'd actually agree with a great deal of what he's saying. But I don't think we do have the time. The Carizians know we're building a navy, and it's not going to be so very much longer before they start dispatching squadrons of their own to do something about that. I realize we're thousands of miles away from Karis here in Dolar, and they've got plenty of things to worry about much closer to home. But they've already demonstrated that they'd send every single galleon they had as far from home as Armageddon Reef when they couldn't even be certain exactly where our ships were. I see no reason to believe they wouldn't send a powerful detachment of their present, much larger galleon fleet to our own waters to harass us when they do know exactly where to find us, and it's not as if Garath Bay moves around very much.
When that happens, I'll need at least a few squadrons that are ready for the test of battle. It won't help us to have an enormous fleet that isn't ready. We already saw that at Rock Point and Darkos Sound. It will help us to have a battle-ready corps of ships, even if it's relatively small, with some chance of meeting the Carizzians on an equal basis.
I understand, Admiral Thirsk, Mike said quietly. And I agree. I'll do all in my power to support you, both with Mother Church and with His Majesty. Of course, I may have to be a little indirect in some instances. As I've already pointed out, the Duke has powerful connections and allies of his own. The longer I can keep him from realizing I've decided to throw you my full support, the slower he'll be to start using those connections and allies effectively.
Thirsk nodded, and the bishop smiled thinly.
I can already think of a few ways to blunt some of his objections, at least in the short term, and probably without his realizing I'm doing it deliberately. And I think it's going to be important that you and I stay discreetly, Admiral, in communication outside official channels.
He shook his head.
It shouldn't be necessary for Mother Church's defenders to creep around, hiding what they're up to, simply in order to defend her effectively. Unfortunately, God gave man free will, and not all of us exercise it wisely. In fact, some of us are horses' asses.
Thirsk surprised himself with a laugh, and the bishop smiled at him.
Well, there's no point pretending an onion is a rose, now is there? Although, in the case of a certain nobleman we've been discussing this morning, I think it's rather more a case of a pile of dragon shit smelling like a rose. So, for what it's worth, and as long as I'm in a position to do it, I'll see what I can do about sweeping as much as possible of that shit out of your path. Beyond that, the bishop looked directly into Thirsk's eyes, his expression suddenly sober. It's going to be up to you and Admiral Holland.
4. Kazimar Prison, City of Manchir, and Crag House, City of Valena, Earldom of Craggy Hill. Father Adrian Wyman stood gazing out the barred window at the gallows in the prison courtyard. Those gallows had been busy over the last few 5 days, and he'd been able to recognize the faces of at least a quarter of the condemned men as they were marched up the steep wooden stairs to the waiting nooses. "I suppose I should be flattered they've let me wait till last," he thought. "The bastards." His face tightened, and his nostrils flared as he ran his hand over the plain, scratchy prison tunic which had replaced his silken cassock. They'd graciously allowed him to retain his scepter, and his fingers sought the familiar, comforting weight hanging around his neck. But that was as far as they were prepared to go. He held the scepter tight, leaning his forehead against the bars, and remembered fury, and little though he cared to admit it, terror, flowed through him. He still had no idea who had betrayed him. Someone had to have. Worse, it had to have been someone from within his own order, and that was bitter as gall on his tongue. Yet, as much as it sickened him to confront the truth, that was the only way they could have known where to find him at St. Justin's. Only the Order of Schuler had known about the concealed rooms, the secret entrance at the far end of the carefully hidden tunnel. And it had to have been someone close to him, someone he'd trusted, because that eternally damned traitor Garvai had known exactly who to scoop up. In that single disastrous night, he and the other traitors on the Regency Council had completely decapitated, no, completely destroyed, the resistance organization Wyman had so carefully and laboriously constructed. It turned his stomach. Literally, he could feel the nausea churning in his belly even now. To know that native-born Coruscandians, men who claimed to love God, had knowingly and deliberately shattered the only organized resistance in Manchir to the filth and poison and lies of the accursed, apostate heretics who served the Church of Karis. He choked the nausea down and forced himself to inhale deeply, opening his eyes and staring at the gallows once again. Tomorrow, it would be his turn to mount those stairs. He felt fear flutter at the base of his throat at that thought, but once again, anger dominated fear. He was willing to die for God, and he made no apologies for defending God's true will, his plan for all men, against the impious lies and perversions of others. But he was an ordained, consecrated priest. He was no common felon, no casual criminal, to be hanged by the unconsecrated hands of secular authority, even if he'd acknowledged for one heartbeat the legitimacy of that authority. The writ itself made that blindingly clear. Only Mother Church held authority over her clergy. Only she could decree their punishment, and only she could carry it out.
But they've got an answer for that too, don't they?
His lips drew back in a snarl, and his grip on his pectoral scepter went white-knuckled.
The civil authorities can't hang a priest? Very well, just strip him of his priesthood.
And that was precisely what they'd done. The excommunicate traitors had dared, to defrock a priest made by the Grand Vicar's hands in the temple itself. They'd set their Shan Wei accursed pride and arrogance above all else, above the archangels and even God himself, and told him he was no longer God's priest. That they, had judged him a criminal, not simply against the secular puppets of Karis, but against the law of God. They had declared that the execution of the traitor Hoskins had been not the Inquisition's justice, but simple murder. And that even greater traitor Gerling, Archbishop Claremont, had actually stood in judgment and declared that he, Wyman, as the one who had ordered that execution, had violated the sanctity of the priesthood by his actions. Gerling, the forsworn, excommunicated apostate, had passed judgment on the legitimate intendant of Coruscant and, in profane and heretical violation of every ecclesiastic law, expelled Wyman from the priesthood of the church for the torture and murder of a fellow priest, brother, and innocent child of God. Wyman had been unable to believe anyone could have the sheer effrontery, the insolence before God, to claim authority to do any such thing. Yet the archbishop had done precisely that, and the secular authorities had accepted his judgment. Indeed, they had applauded it. He realized his teeth were grinding once again and made himself stop. It wasn't easy. He'd gotten into the habit over the 5 days of his imprisonment, and he smiled bleakly, without humor, as he reflected that at least he wouldn't have to worry about that particular problem very much longer. He pushed away from the window and paced slowly back and forth across his cell. It was better than some cells, he supposed, but once again, it was the cell of a common criminal. 10 feet on a side, with a narrow cot, one table, a chair, a pitcher of water, a wash basin, a battered cup, and a chamber pot. That was all, aside from the copy of the Holy Writ they'd oh so graciously permitted him. The austerity had been yet one more calculated insult, a way to underscore their contempt for the man who was Mother Church's chosen champion. In the end, though, they hadn't had the courage or the insolence to truly carry through on the beliefs they proclaimed so loudly. Adrian Wyman was only too well aware of the penalties the Book of Schuller prescribed for anyone guilty of the crimes for which they had convicted him. Indeed, what had been done to the traitor Hoskins had been well short of the fullness of those penalties. It had simply been the best that could be done in the time and with the tools available. Wyman was a Schulerite. If anyone knew that, he did, and he wasn't going to pretend, even to himself, that he wasn't prayerfully grateful they'd been too cowardly to put him to the question or decree the punishment of Schuler. The thought of the wheel, the rack, the white-hot irons, of castration and blinding, of having his belly slit and his intestines drawn forth living, and then the fire, was enough to terrify any man, and rightly so. Schuler had instituted those penalties as much to deter such crimes as to punish them. Yet, had Archbishop Clermont and his lapdog Regency Council truly possessed the courage of their convictions, they would have decreed the full punishment of Schuler for his alleged crimes, not settled for a simple hanging. His lips twitched with contempt as he recalled what the Church of Carus called an interrogation. They'd refused to employ even the most gentle of the Inquisition's techniques. Sleep deprivation, yes, and endless relays of interrogators hammering away, hammering away, hammering away. And he had to admit they'd gotten more out of him than he'd expected. That had been mostly because they already knew so much, though. It had proven far harder than he'd ever anticipated not to answer their questions when they'd already demonstrated they knew at least 2/3 of the answers before they ever asked. And, as the fatigue mounted, it had become harder and harder to prevent little bits and pieces from dribbling out. "But they didn't get the big admission out of me," he thought grimly. "They came closer than they ever guessed more than once, but they never got it. That secret held, at least. They knew, or they sure as Shan Wei suspected, who gave the order, but they obviously don't have any evidence of it, and Kaming, at least, must have gotten away. That bastard would have betrayed me in a minute if the offer was right. But they never got me to admit it, not once." His eyes flickered with grim, hating triumph and contempt for his enemies at the thought. "The fools. Anyone can be made to confess with the proper persuasion. An inquisitor knows that if anyone does. If they'd been willing to put the question, they'd have gotten it out of me, however hard I tried to resist. But the cowards wouldn't do it." The secular authorities had been more willing to accept rigorous techniques. Indeed, Wyman had been shocked by the readiness of common soldiers to lay violent, impious hands on his person. It seemed the traitor Hoskins had been even more popular with Garvai's troops than with the bulk of Manchir's citizens. The sheer blazing hatred in their eyes when they learned Wyman had ordered the priest's kidnapping and execution had stunned the intendant, and the fists and boots which followed had been even worse. He'd been battered, bruised, bleeding, half-naked, and less than half-conscious when a captain, 2 lieutenants, and a quartet of leather-lunged sergeants rescued him. And there'd been a time or two here in the prison when one of his jailers had helped him fall, or a pair of them had administered a brutally skilled, methodical beating that left no bruises where anyone was likely to see them. At first, he'd thought the soldiers responsible for those actions had actually been acting under orders, that they were the true face of the Church of Carus's pious public disavowal of the Inquisition's methods. But he'd gradually decided he was wrong. First, because it was so haphazard, so uncoordinated and inefficient. Any inquisitor worth his salt would have managed the whole thing far better, far more effectively, without ever officially questioning the prisoner. Wyman had done precisely that at least a dozen times during his own novitiate, after all. But secondly, and probably even more conclusive, at least 3 jailers who'd been responsible for giving him special treatment had been severely disciplined by their own superiors. It hadn't stopped the occasional abuse, yet he was convinced their punishment had been genuine. When he'd finally accepted that, he'd felt two conflicting emotions. One was an even deeper contempt for his captors, for their craven refusal to interrogate him effectively, even under the cover of spontaneous actions by common soldiers. But the other, the one which still shocked and confused him, was the realization that the soldiers were doing it on their own. That the troopers were so furious over Hoskins' death that they were actually defying orders to beat and abuse a consecrated priest. And worse, far worse, was the crushing realization that the soldiers weren't alone in their anger. Despite everything else they'd done, his captors had at least permitted him access to clergy. He had no doubt their willingness to allow that was just as much a thing of cynical calculation as everything else they'd done, but he couldn't pretend he wasn't grateful. They'd even allowed him a true priest, one of God's servants who'd had the integrity and moral and spiritual courage to remain an openly observant temple loyalist, rather than giving him the opportunity to reject their own false and faithless clergy. He'd been permitted to make confession, but as a condemned murderer, he was not permitted to speak privately even with his confessor. A priest of the Church of Carus was always present, sworn, of course, to respect the sanctity of the confessional, not that Wyman believed for a moment he actually would, even as he enforced the legal restrictions upon the confessional. That had prevented Wyman from using it to pass messages to anyone outside the prison via the confessor. On the other hand, he hadn't had anyone left to pass messages to either, given the clean sweep Garvey had made. But the confessor's thrice of 5-day visits had given him at least a limited window on events beyond Casimar Prison's walls, and that window had confirmed his captor's version of events in Manchir. The other priest hadn't wanted to tell him that, out of pity and compassion, Wyman suspected. He hadn't wanted the intendant to discover how completely and utterly he'd failed. Yet, in the end, the bits and pieces he'd been willing to admit had convinced Wyman the stories of his interrogators, the taunts of his jailers, and the jeers of the common soldiers had been only too true. So now he was to hang, his great work in God's name completely undone by the stupid credulity and gushing sentimentality of the ignorant, unwashed cretins who had allowed themselves to slobber over a single provincial upper priest and the justified fate his betrayal of God and his own vows had brought upon him. Adrian Wyman closed his eyes again, pacing, 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 while the smoking lava of hatred, failure, and despair flowed through him.
"It's confirmed, Your Eminence," Wallace Hillkeeper, the Earl of Craggy Hill, said grimly. "I've just had a runner from the semaphore station. They hanged him this morning."
"May God and the archangels welcome him as their own,"
Bishop Executor Thomas Schiller murmured, tracing Langhorne's scepter. There was a moment of silence, a stillness, in the luxurious appointed chamber. It was so quiet they could hear the distant voices of the city of Valena from beyond the walls of the Earl's palatial residence. Craghouse was more mansion than castle, although it was surrounded by a 20-foot wall. It was also large enough and possessed of enough unobtrusive entrances and exits that Schiller felt reasonably safe visiting it. It wasn't as remote and as secure as the tiny monastery outside Cerebor, where he'd been the guest of Amelaine Garnot, the legitimate Bishop of Larchros, but it was secure enough. Especially now that Craggy Hill, like the Earl of Stormkeep and Baron Larchros, had quietly increased his own strength of armsmen.
"And to be honest," Schiller thought now, "I feel a lot more secure here than I felt in Sardor."
The Bishop Executor's well-trained face showed no sign of his mental grimace. He and Marak Holland, his secretary and aide, had been the guests of Melvin Norcross, the Bishop of Barkor, for almost a month before they moved on to Larchros. Norcross was one of the senior clergymen who'd sworn obedience to the Church of Karras in order to retain his see, and he'd offered what seemed the most promising port in the storm when Shalaer fled Manchir. In the event, however, Norcross's palace in Sardor, the capital of the Barony of Barkor, had proved less suitable than he'd hoped. The fact that Norcross had sworn to obey and follow directives from Archbishop Claremont had bothered neither him nor Shalaer, since no one could swear a valid oath to someone Mother Church had excommunicated. And Shalaer was confident of Norcross's loyalty to the legitimate church. His outrage and anger over the heresy of the Church of Karras certainly seemed genuine, even if a bishop who'd officially pledged his loyalty to that church had to be careful about where he allowed them to show. And, if nothing else, the Bishop of Barkor was in too deep to back out now. But that hadn't made Shalaer any happier about being dependent upon the Baron of Barkor for his security. He'd come to the conclusion that Sir Ger Sumiers, the current Baron, was much better at bluster and promises than at action. His efforts to increase his force of personal armsmen were pathetic compared to those of men like Craggy Hill and Baron Larchros, and he was far more willing to make extravagant guarantees in private conversation than to run the slightest risk to bring those guarantees to fruition. In fact, Shalaer had concluded that for all of Barkor's undoubted hatred for Sir Corin Garvai and the members of the Regency Council, he was far too timid to do anything likely to draw attention his way. He was willing enough to talk, even to shovel substantial sums of money in the resistance's direction, but not to risk coming out into the open.
"He's covering his arse is what he's doing," Shalaer thought coldly. "If we win, when we win, he'll remind us all that he was on our side from the very beginning, and he'll expect his share of Mother Church's reward to her loyal sons. And if it should happen that we don't win, he'll go back into hiding and pretend he didn't know anything about it."
"Not him. Why, he's always been a loyal and faithful subject of Prince Dyvan. One who'd never dream of defying the legitimate orders of Dyvan's regents. And as for ecclesiastic matters, he's certainly not qualified to make such judgments. Who is he to set his judgment above the confirmed and consecrated archbishop sitting in Manchir? The very notion never entered his head."
But thinking of Barkor left a bad taste in the bishop executor's mouth, and he didn't need any more bad tastes on top of Craggy Hill's news. He pushed the absent Baron resolutely to the back of his mind and considered the men sitting around the table with him.